Shrink Wrap Radio number 547, Exploring Compassion Focused Therapy with Dr. Paul Gilbert.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with UK psychologist Dr. Paul Gilbert about his pioneering work in the area of compassion-focused psychotherapy. For more information about Dr. Paul Gilbert, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Dr. Paul Gilbert, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you very much, David. It's great to be invited onto your radio. That's wonderful.
Well, it's wonderful for me. I'm really glad that we finally have the opportunity, because we tried to do this about a year ago, and somehow our wires got crossed. I think it was my wires that got crossed. And I know that you're super busy, so I'm very grateful for this opportunity to speak with you today.
My pleasure.
So first of all, you know, we're going to be talking about your work in compassion-focused therapy. So I wanted to ask you, when and how did you become interested in compassion?
Probably in the late 80s. I was trained in cognitive therapy originally. I've done trainings as well. And in that kind of therapy, what you do is you help people to identify some of the thoughts that are associated with their negative emotion. Could be anxiety, the fear of having a heart attack, for example, or it could be depression, the idea of being inferior or loser or defeated. And then what you help people do is to stand back and generate alternative thoughts. Okay, so I feel I'm a failure, but let me look at the evidence for that. I have friends, I have a family, or I've held down a job, or whatever it is. So we found that people could generate alternative thoughts, okay, but when you ask them, how do you hear them in your mind? How do you hear those alternatives? How do you hear those helpful thoughts? It turned out that the emotional texture of the thinking was hostile. Mm-hmm. But they would have thoughts like, come on, you know, look at the evidence. You're not a failure. You know you're not a failure. You've got a friends, haven't you?
Yeah.
So the first thing we try to do is to teach people how to generate a kind and friendly voice tone. That was the first thing. Mm-hmm. Because they found it very difficult to create friendly voice tones in the head. And in fact, many people who have all emotional difficulties, depression, anxiety, and also people who have psychosis and schizophrenia and hear voices, the tone is often very hostile, contemptuous.
Exactly, yeah.
So that was the beginning, really, of teaching people how to have friendly tone. And then we taught them how to have compassionate motivation and then engage in compassionate behavior. So it kind of grew from those observations that many of the people that we were trying to help found it very difficult to generate compassion, particularly for themselves.
Now, were you already, compassion has a lot of play these days, as Buddhism has taken a very strong hold in the West. And so were you already on that sort of path, or was this independent of that?
Well, it's a great question, David, because I've been interested in Buddhism since my teens, really. Kind of on the periphery, sort of looking in. When at university, I did a bit of Om meditation, Maharishi with the Beatles and all that kind of stuff. Okay. So I always had sort of an interest, but not terribly serious. And then gradually, I became more interested in some of the deeper philosophies and concepts of Buddhism, particularly the concept of how compassion motivation organizes our mind. So we know that the things that you're motivated to do, if you're motivated to make a lot of money, or you're motivated to be a great football star or whatever it is, that will organize how you pay attention, how you think, the things that you make you happy, the things that make you miserable. And it turns out that having compassion motivation really does help us to feel better in ourselves and also have more meaning in life. That's been something the Buddha talked about many thousands of years ago. So mindfulness, being aware of what's happening in your mind, and having this motivation to create well-being for others, that's very important in our approach.
Sure. And what you're saying reminds me of Ram Dass years ago. I think he was quoting an Indian saying, said, a thief only sees a man's pockets. So it's to that point that you're making of that what we focus on really shapes our experience.
Very much so. What we focus on shapes our experience. And the point is, you well know that we're very orientated in the West now towards competitiveness, you know, the social media, my presentation on Facebook and making sure I'm as good as other people. So that focus on this competitive dynamic in life increases the risk of people feeling ashamed, inferior, and being self-critical, whereas a compassion focus reduces that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting to kind of wonder, well, where does this critical part come from? So you think it's, do you think it's cultural that so many of us are so prone to have that kind of negative self-judgment?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, some of it is obviously family of origin, particularly if you grew up in a family who, you know, hostile to you or whatever, you know, abuse and all of that. But it's also very interesting to see what's happened to our entertainments over the last 20 years. So if you think about competitive programs, then the Olympic ideal is to celebrate winning and achievement. So the winner takes the prizes and everybody else goes to the restaurant and gets drunk or whatever. But now, if you look at a lot of the shows that we have, it's all about focusing people who get chucked out. So each week, it's who are we going to chuck out this week? Who's going to be rejected this week? Who's not going to make it this week? A lot more focus on shaming people. Mm-hmm. So the issue of shaming and excluding people and the fear of being excluded is very prominent in our society these days. The concept of community, being looked after by one's community, that isn't nearly as prevalent as it used to be. So the fears of not being good enough, I think, are very serious for some of our younger people. And that leads to a lot of self-criticism, even for some people, self-hatred, particularly for young ladies who might have body shapes that are very difficult to stereotype.
Yeah. And we are social creatures. And so there's a very deep need to be part of the group. For survival. So that's kind of a very core meditation.
Very much.
I was reading one of your papers in which you were defining compassion, and I seem to recall that there were two components. There was a feeling component, and I think that maybe the other component was sort of an action one. I'm not sure if I remember that correctly.
Yes. So we define compassion in fact very... it's fairly standard in many ways of having two components to it. So there's a sensitivity to suffering itself and others. In other words, the first part is that you're prepared to pay attention rather than just block it out or justify or dissociate or not notice or whatever. So the first thing is preparedness to engage with suffering. That's the first thing. And then the second thing is the preparedness to have to learn the wisdom of knowing what to do. Now, the wisdom component of compassion is often forgotten, but it's extremely important. If I see somebody fall into the river and I think I must jump in and save them, that's compassionate intention. But if I remember halfway through my jump I can't swim, then that's not very sensible. So if you wanted to be a medical doctor and save people from horrible diseases, that's wonderful. But if you weren't prepared to study and learn how to do it, that wouldn't be so wonderful. So compassion isn't just about having these feeling states. It also has, in terms of therapy anyway, it also has to have this motivation to realize that we need to acquire the wisdom to know how best to do to alleviate suffering and prevent suffering.
Okay. On your website, you say that many people equate compassion with kindness, but that in fact, research shows that it's more associated more strongly with courage. That was a little surprising. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, kindness is great. I mean, we're not against kindness. And compassion wouldn't be unkind, of course. But if I remember your birthday, that's kind. If I buy you a present you always wanted, because I know how much you wanted it, that would be seen as a kind act. But I don't think you would call it a compassionate act. Compassion needs to involve this preparedness to address suffering. In other words, the preparedness for you to suffer yourself a little bit on behalf of the other. So, for example, if you give money to a homeless person, then you are prepared to give up that money for them so you don't have it. Or if you do a favor for a friend, you're prepared to give up that time that you could have spent for yourself to give something for them. So kindness is great. I'm not against that. But compassion involves this whole issue of suffering. And that is the courage part of it, you see, because the preparedness to engage. And for those people who follow religion, the interesting thing in the Christian story of compassion is, of course, courage. The courage of Christ. So courage is absolutely central. So you wouldn't call Christ's act of sacrifice kindness. You would call it deep compassion.
Mm-hmm. In fact, I wrote something down from your website that I'd like to read here. I've got it in front of me. You wrote, "Compassion is one of the most important declarations of strength and courage known to humanity. It's difficult and powerful, infectious and influential. It is a universally recognized motivation with the ability to change the world." So that's a pretty strong claim, changing the world. What's the evidence for what you're saying here?
Well, there's a lot of evidence that if we choose compassion over, say, self-hatred or tribalism, we will make the world a better place. I think if you think in your workplace, if your employees treat you with compassion, they treat you fairly and justly, that's a much better place to work than if they just treat you as an object to make as much money for them as they can. One of the big problems we have is humans have brains which are multiple. So we can be fantastic, we can have medicine and so forth, but we can also be pretty awful. If you look at the history of humanity, from the Roman games all the way through to the kinds of wars that we fought and how we fought those wars and the things that we do in those wars and the tortures and the crucifixions that we've come up with, it's pretty bad. So compassion, on the other hand, is a motive that seeks to address suffering, not to cause it. So the first aspect of compassion is, may I address suffering? And I certainly don't want to be a cause of it. So if you could imagine that everybody had that, rather than tribalism, at the center of their being, that would certainly make the world a much better place.
Yeah, it certainly would. So as we've already noted, compassion is strongly rooted in Buddhist philosophy and Buddhist practices. At the same time, you and others in the West have done a lot of work relating the notion of compassion to Western psychological constructs and also to evolution. So tell us about that research that's coming out of the West to build the edifice that seems to be emerging here.
Well, it's a great point. I think the issue of the Buddhist aspect of compassion is important because they had practices. But of course, in many spiritualities, particularly Christianity, compassion is at the center of those spiritual traditions. You know, the concept of the Good Samaritan and so on and so on. So it's not only in Buddhism, but Buddhism has a series of practices. Now, those practices have recently been studied in the West. So, for example, what happens if people practice loving kindness meditations over a period of weeks and months? And what we see is there are changes in the human brain. We used to think that the human brain was sort of, once it got to a certain age, was static and it was all downhill from there. But we now know that the human brain actually is relatively plastic. This is called neuroplasticity. Mm-hmm. That is, the brain itself can change the result of the experiences that it has. And compassion training actually changes the brain in subtle ways, but in important ways. So you get changes in the frontal cortex, you get changes in the way people regulate their attention and their emotion. We also know that there is a part of the autonomic nervous system called the vagus or the vagal nerve.
Right.
And again, if you do training in compassion, you change the vagal tone. So researchers have begun to really study some of the physiological effects of what happens when you train into compassion. If, on the other hand, I was to train you in anger, how to always be aggressive, always, then your brain would change in a very different way.
That's called the military.
Yes. That's called it. So it would be
Yeah, Yeah. Now, if somebody wanted to go more deeply into the research, I have the feeling that you've written books that maybe review some of that. Is there a book, your own or somebody else's, that you would particularly refer someone to, who the sort of hard-minded scientist type who would like to say, well, you know, show me?
Yes. Well, I think the science is, as you say, is extremely important, because none of us want to believe in fairy tales or believe things just because they're nice stories. We do need the evidence that if you stimulate these motivational systems in your brain, they will do things to your brain and your body. So that's clear. And that's pretty easy to demonstrate. I mean, you know, if you're hungry and you see a meal, this will stimulate your hypothalamus and give your stomach acids and saliva, make your saliva flow. But if you're very hungry and you just imagine a meal, then the imagery would do the same thing. If you see something a little bit erotic on the television, that might give you arousal. But you can also imagine, just create it in your mind. So what we know is what we create in our minds, the images that we have, will stimulate different physiological systems. That's clear, right? So the question is can you teach people to generate certain images or practices where they're specifically stimulating brain systems and body systems? And there's overwhelming evidence that you can do that. So where is all that evidence? Well, at the moment, it's a little bit scattered about in the literature. But actually, we have a book coming out on compassion, which will be out in May by Routledge, bringing some of that evidence together. And there's also the Compassion in Mind book, which came out in 2009, carries some of that evidence, some of my books. But there is also other wonderful books out there on compassion and compassion research.
Yes. Well, let's focus more on compassion-based therapy. Sort of a marriage there of the compassion practice. And were you the first person to use that term, compassion-focused therapy?
I don't know. You always worry when you say that, because I'm not sure. Possibly.
Okay.
Possibly not. I mean, you often think, oh, you're the first, and then you find that 300 years ago people were doing these.
Yeah, but you might be. Let's say you are among the very first in the West, maybe, to do this. And pardon me, I'm getting over something here. So mindfulness training is a key component of that approach, right?
Yeah.
And what are some of the other components of compassion-focused therapy that helps to move it into the realm of therapy?
Okay, so that's great. So firstly, we try to identify where you are stuck. And if you're suffering from anxiety or depression, so anxiety people, they tend to be stuck in seeing the world as full of threats. Socially anxious people are worried about how they're judged by others. People with panic attacks can be worried about having heart attacks. People with OCD can be worried about germs. Depressed people feel failures and unlovable and so on. So you find out where the grip in the threat system is. Now, the next thing then is to help people think that, look, if you could bring a compassion orientation to this problem, how would it be? If you were at your compassionate best and wisest, how would you like to see this problem? So what we do is we then train people in such a way that they can stimulate the physiological states that bring on compassion. So one of the things we do is to teach them posture. For example, when you're in a threat state, depressed and anxious, your body always automatically curls inwards. Your shoulders come in to protect the front of the body and so on. So the first thing is making sure that your shoulders are up and back. This opens the diaphragm area. And when you do that, you have a slight curve in your back that way. Yeah. When you slump forward, it goes that way. So you want that. So this opens up your chest, and this tells the body that actually you're kind of coming. Then we invite you to breathe at about 5 breaths per minute. So breathing deeper and slower than you would normally, and focusing on the sensation of slowing down with each out breath. You also slow your voice. So the voice becomes mind slowing down. See, not mind slowing down, but mind slowing down. So as you breathe out, you really focus on this sensation and you create a friendly voice tone. So you've got the posture, the breathing, the voice tone. Then you also imagine yourself greeting a friend. So you create in your face a compassionate facial expression. So those are the kind of the grounding parts. The next part is to focus on the concept of what is compassionate wisdom. And here we do use some of the evolutionary ideas. Then we focus on the concept of grounding, because when you do the breathing, you feel slightly heavy and grounded. And then we do the concept of commitment, of being committed that wherever I encounter suffering, be it in myself or others, I would try to bring my wisdom to do something about it. Mm-hmm. But when you ask people to then really practice that and imagine themselves at their compassionate best, at their most courageous, the most committed, they very often have their own solutions to their problems. It's just that they've never given themselves space to really stop and think. So imagine that you have an argument with your partner. Supposing you could stop and think to yourself, okay, I'm very angry right now, but if I was at my calmest, if I was at my wisest, if I was at my compassionate, how would I like to deal with this situation? So the mindfulness then is learning that certain states of mind are not going to help you solve your difficulties. But if you move into this slowing the breath, grounding the body, focusing on compassionate intention, this can give you a way of bringing your own wisdom to that situation.
Be very hard to argue against that. I mean, it just makes so much sense. Now, in the first, when you began to talk about it, I was hearing your cognitive behavior therapy roots. So that's one part of this approach of compassion-focused therapy. I can hear that, at least as you teach it and practice it, there's a lot of CBT. Right? Cognitive behavioral therapy. I'm wondering if there are people who start with a different base. Are there people who start from, say, a psychodynamic base? And if that would look different from the outside or the inside?
It's a great question. I think the way, basically, our approach is really to bring this orientation to whatever therapy you're doing. Because our view is that it's a little bit like climbing Mount Everest. You can teach people how to climb. You can give them wonderful ropes and boots. But if they're unfit, they're never going to make it. So if they're not able to create some kind of stable, compassionate base, then when they try to engage in the cognitive or the behavioral stuff, it just overwhelms them because they don't have enough inner stability. They don't have enough, they just become very self-critical or hostile or I can't do it, or they don't have enough of this, what we would call mental fitness, to be able to do the stuff they need to do. Now, that's important. So whatever therapy you're doing, whatever therapy you're engaging in, we would argue that if you do this training, what we call compassionate mind training, they are fitter, they're stronger, they're more able to do the therapy that you have. Psychodynamic people will focus more on allowing people or enabling people to notice certain kinds of emotions or memories arising as they arise. But what we find is that in the end, that from whatever therapeutic background you come to, there is this movement towards understanding that if you can create this inner compassionate state for people, they will find their own wisdom. Sometimes you have to guide them a little bit. So, for example, if you're having an argument, some therapists will teach people to pay attention to the mind of the other, to remember an argument is always a twosome, never a onesome, and to think about what's happening in the mind of the other person. Mm. Again, if you can produce this state, you'll be able to do it. If you just stay angry, then you're not interested in the mind of the other person. You're just interested in them listening to you. So I did a lot of training in Jungian archetypal psychotherapy as well.
Oh, so goody. That's one of my favorite topics.
So I did training in that for a number of years. So
interesting.
That's some of the evolutionary stuff that you see in the work that we do is really the base. How do you move the basic archetypes around? So compassion really is an archetype. That's another way of thinking about it.
Yeah, that's interesting that you don't see an incompatibility there.
No.
Nor do I. And I have a sense that that there's an emerging consensus about psychotherapy, that the schools of thought, the historical schools of thought are becoming less important. And that there's more of a sense of what works and more of a commonality that's emerging. Do you have that sense at all?
Oh, that's absolutely true, David. Yeah, absolutely true. And the reason for that is because we're all becoming more science-based. I mean, if you look at a lot of the therapies, right, Freudian therapy, Beckian therapy, all of these therapies, they were originally based on people's observations. So Freud made many of his developed many of his theories from observations of what people said under the conditions of free associations. Professor Beck made many of his developed his therapy on the basis of observations of automatic thoughts that flow through people's minds, right? So what we're moving towards now is not, as you say, the tribes, but how does the brain actually work? We're not interested in theories of cognition or motivation or emotion, because all these are important. We need to know, how does motivation work? How does emotion work? What's the role of personality? What's the role of background and environment? We now know, for example, that your environment can even change your genetic expression.
Yeah.
So all of the therapies are gradually beginning to pull out of the same basket of scientific evidence of how the brain actually works. And we're beginning to look at, so if you have somebody with this kind of difficulty, how can you help them? As opposed to what therapy should they have? There is still quite a lot of tribalism, I have to say, in psychotherapy, but it is the generations to coming are becoming more scientific slowly, slowly.
Yeah, I like that term tribalism. I haven't heard it used in this context, so that's I'm going to try to remember that. And you mentioned some things that compassion-based therapy seems to be particularly good for, such as anxiety and so on. Are there conditions for which it would be counterindicated?
That's a wonderful question. I'm not sure. We don't have any evidence for counterindication. What we do have is that some individuals really struggle with it. Compassion frightens them. Okay. And part of the reason it frightens them is they may feel they don't deserve it, or they may feel that, you know, people who were kind to me in the past also abused me. So there can be all kinds of reasons why people have what we call fears, blocks, and resistances to it. Some powerful business people, for example, don't like the idea of compassion at all, because they say, you know, life is about being tough and making tough decisions, and there's no room for compassion. So people have all kinds of resistances to compassion. So that is true. Whether it's contraindicated for some patients, that's unclear.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, I understand, you know, we were talking about therapy and that you developed a compassion-focused therapy compassion scale.
Yeah.
So what can you tell us about the scale? And, you know, what problem was that designed to solve? It's a lot of work, probably, to develop it.
Yeah, there are a number of very good scales out there already. Our approach is a motivation approach. Not all approaches to compassion are a motivation approach. Some people have a more diagnostic or what we call phenomenological approach, where they try to identify the key phenomenon or the key symptoms, if you like, of compassion. Whereas ours is a motivational approach. Now, when it comes to motivation, then you need to know the competencies that go with that motivation. So imagine reproduction or sexual behavior. So firstly, you have to be aroused by a stimulus, but then you have to know what to do. So birds would be engaged in a courting dance or whatever it is. So you need this stimulus, this activation, and then this capacity for action. So our scale has 12 competencies. There are 6 competencies for engagement. So the 6 competencies for engagement are, firstly, you're motivated rather than you're not. Then you know how to pay attention. That's your mindfulness. When you begin to pay attention to suffering, that will cause you to have an emotional feeling of sorrow or sadness or whatever. We call that sympathy. You have to be able to tolerate that. So distress tolerance, for example, if you engage with suffering, then you can't tolerate it. It's too much. It overpowers you. That's the end of the game, because you pull out at that point. And then the 5th one is empathy, the ability to understand the emotions and what's going on. And then the 6th one is non-judgment, not getting angry about it. So when we train in compassion-focused therapy, we train people in the motivation, how to pay attention, right? How to tolerate the emotions that are arising as they arise, how to make sense of those emotions. So then the 2nd psychology is the psychology of, now I can pay attention to my suffering, but can I pay attention to what is going to be helpful? Can I I think in a way that's going to be helpful to me? Can I behave in a way that's going to be helpful to me? So, for example, if you are agoraphobic, then compassionate behavior isn't sitting at home watching TV because that feels safe. The compassionate behavior is the courage to go out and face your anxiety and gradually tolerate and overcome your anxiety. So there are six competencies that go with the action component. So we have a scale that measures them, and we measure them in terms of flow. So there are the competencies that you have. Are you able to be, do you care about yourself? Are you sensitive to your pain? Can you make sense of it? Can you tolerate it? Are you, then we have it for others, which would then be, can you be sensitive to the pain of others? Can you tolerate the pain of others? Can you make sense of it? And we also have it coming into you. Are you aware when other people are sensitive to you? Are you aware that they can tolerate your distress? Do you feel that people try to understand you? So our scales are based on this motivational approach, which has these competencies sitting underneath it. And then we measure these competencies. And in our therapy, those are what we try to develop. So, for example, some patients have a lot of motivation, they have a lot of desire, but they're not very good with empathy. They don't really understand, they don't know how to work out how other people think. Or they might be very keen, but they become overwhelmed very easily. They're not very good at tolerating. They want to be able to tolerate pain, but they become overwhelmed.
Well, I could see the value of a scale like that, for example, to do research on effectiveness of treatment. Yeah. And to see in what ways people are getting better, developing these capabilities. I could see its usefulness in the training of therapists in maybe watching videotapes. Has it been used in that way?
Yes, it has. Yes,
yeah. Yeah, good. And and training. Now, you do training. I was going to ask you, you know, where can somebody get trained in this? So maybe I should ask that now. This is a good place. A sizable portion of my audience are either therapists already or people who are on the way to becoming therapists.
Yes, well, I think in America, there's the self-compassion people, which is Christian Neff and Chris Germer. And you can go onto their website, just put selfcompassion.org. They have a different model than we do, but they work more with the general population rather than people with mental health problems. But they have a very well worked out training. And we are developing our training in America. We have a person called Dennis Turch, T-I-R-C-H, who has the Compassionate Mind USA, which is based in New York, and he runs training, and we're developing our training in America.
Okay, and I interviewed Kristen Neff some years back, so I definitely recognize that name.
So they have a very well worked out. They also now are doing training for trainers. So that they can teach other people to train in their model.
Right, right.
We're nowhere near as worked out as they are because we're a psychotherapy rather than a general mind development.
Mm-hmm. But,
we're getting there.
Yeah. You've already spoken to this, but one of the questions I wanted to ask was, to what extent does a compassion-focused therapists need to embrace Buddhism?
No, they don't.
They don't. They just don't need to at all.
No. I mean, I think it's very important for us to be honest about how we use traditional contemplative practices in our training. That's just being honest. But these practices also have to stand the test of science. And so, therefore, they help you or they won't. So, does the breathing exercises... I mean, a lot of breathing exercises were originally developed in the Buddhist and contemplative traditions, the concept of the prana breath, right? Does that breathing actually do what it says on the tin? Will it actually help stimulate your vagus system? Will it actually help you feel grounded, get your parasympathetic system? And the answer is absolutely it does. So you don't need to know anything about the Buddhist. All you need to know is that if you train your in this breathing techniques, this will have an impact on your body.
Yeah. Yeah, there are some people who actually, remembering some interviews on the topic of mindfulness, and there are people who are concerned that it's getting too secularized and that something will be lost if it's all stripped down to just the mechanics.
Yeah. Well, I think the key is always to remember that you add to the fruit in the basket, not take away. So I think there will always be individuals who follow very much very strict Tibetan traditions and are very scholarly. And it's very important that they keep that alive. But I think the point that you're making is a very, very important one, that if the identification of these practices of Buddhism is a barrier to people because it clashes with their religion or whatever, then that would be sad, because what we would like people to see is that if you are interested in Buddhism, please go and check that out. There's some fascinating and very important philosophies in that tradition, but you don't need to be a Buddhist in order to benefit from some of the techniques that Buddhism and some of the contemplative traditions, including Christianity and so on, have given us.
I think I recall reading, maybe it was on your website, I got the impression that self-compassion you actually see as a more advanced stage. Is that right?
Well, part of the issue for self-compassion is we have a view that the human mind is an evolved, we share with many other animals the same motives that they do, to avoid harm and injury, you know, to have a family and look after the kids and be territorial and find somebody to have sex with and all that stuff. So, and of course, animals are also very territorial and very group focused. So we have a brain which orientates us towards all of these things, and some of them can be quite harmful to us. So, for example, if you imagine we have a brain that allows us to think and plan and imagine and self, have a sense of self that no other animal does. We have a capacity for self-knowledge that no other animal does. I mean, if you imagine a zebra running away from a lion, then as soon as the lion is, they've got away from the lion, the zebra will settle down quite quickly. But humans are likely to carry on thinking, can you imagine if I'd been caught? Two lions tomorrow. What about if I don't see them? Or, you know, all this stuff. So we hold in our mind a whole lot of threats and stresses which actually maintain. Now, self-compassion, part of self-compassion in our model is remembering or noticing that one of the reasons you have the problems with your mind that you do, it's not your fault. It's partly mind design. It's partly because our capacity for thinking is sitting on these very old motivational systems, and they can form loops in the mind. So, for example, animals can be tribal, but they don't create nuclear weapons. They don't create religions that they go to war over. We do. So we have the tribal motivation that many animals have, but then we have this other stuff. So again, and we have the competitive psychology, but we can then convince ourselves that we're failures and we're useless and life isn't worth living. No animal, as far as we know, can do that because they don't have that mind. No chimpanzee takes their pulse and worries about having a heart attack, right? So this new mind that we have is great because it can do wonderful things, but it's tricky. You've got to be careful with it. So self-compassion is the beginning to understand how your mind actually is, that this don't own all this stuff as if it's all your fault. You've got all this stuff there, but learning how to drive it. So it's like being in a boat and you get hit by a storm. Don't blame yourself for the storm, but learn how to sail it. Whereas people who have mental health problems, they tend to think it's all about them. You know, this is my anxiety, my depression, it's all my fault. Well, no, it isn't your fault. It's all partly built into you. You keep things learning how you deal with it. That's for us the key to self-compassion, the wisdom to understand your mind.
Yes. You know, mindfulness is now so widespread and popularized. Do you think there's an element of faddishness there that we should be concerned about or not?
Oh, for sure, yeah. And compassion, too. I mean, you know, it's human nature. You know, fads.
It's easy to say these things, right? They trip off the tongue easily enough.
Yeah, I mean, I think absolutely. But on the other hand, if you think, you know, say 50, 60 years ago, I think we are recognizing that we do need to understand our minds better. We do need to work with our minds. We do need to cultivate our minds, because if we don't, they can get up to all kinds of mischief according to the environments in which they operate. There's a lovely story that I often tell, and that is, there is a virus which ants get, and the virus makes the ant climb to the top of a leaf of grass where it will be eaten by a sheep or whatever, and then that virus can reproduce itself in the sheep's stomach, right? What would happen if one day that ant got insight into what was happening to it, and it decided, actually, I have the impulse to climb to the top of this leaf of grass, but I'm not going to do it. So a lot of what we learn is that part of bringing compassion in the world is to inhibit, not to act on things that we feel, not to run away when we're anxious, not to be aggressive when we're angry, not to be greedy when we want to be greedy. So self-knowledge tells us that the brain can lead us into all kinds of difficulties. And by waking up, as it were, using our self-awareness, we can think, I feel like doing this, but I'm not going to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's the beginning of wisdom. Yeah.
It's not my fault. I feel it, but I'm not going to do it.
Yeah. Now, you're the founder of the Compassionate Mind Foundation.
Yeah.
So I'm sure you would love to tell us about the Compassionate Mind Foundation and what the mission of it is, what work it's doing.
Okay, so this is a charity. This is an international charity, and we have centers all over the world. And the idea is to inspire people for the scientific study of compassion, and to use the scientific study of compassion and how we can use the scientific study of compassion to bring about a better world, basically. So we have compassionate schools programs, we have a compassionate business program, and of course the therapy program. So all of these programs really are to do with how can we get compassion as a motivation, teach people the value and the importance of compassion motivation in these different areas of life. And that's what the charity's mission is about. And we're a charity, so we take in donations and we do research projects, and people can do projects through the charity. We bring in researchers if there's money for us to do that. So that's basically what we do, trying as best we can to stimulate research in compassion and the applications of compassion in different walks of life.
Okay. And in terms of compassion-focused therapy, where do you see that going as you take out your crystal ball and look down the road?
Well, I think it's a great question. We call it compassion-focused therapy, not compassion therapy. Mm-hmm. That means that the point that you were making earlier, David, is a very important one. There are many, many interventions in other therapies that are absolutely essential. So, for example, we know that when it comes to anxiety conditions, people often have to expose themselves and learn how to tolerate anxiety. Agoraphobic people very rarely get better unless they practice going out. So, but if you go out with a very kind, supportive voice in your head rather than a critical one, rather than one that's telling you, oh, you're just stupid to have this anxiety, nobody else gets this anxiety, it's only you. If you have a supportive, kind one, you're going to do much better. So I think where we see the future of compassion-focused therapy is learning how to blend all these kind of other interventions with this compassion approach. So compassion-focused therapy isn't the root of all interventions. It is a focus. It's if you can get this compassionate self going and get these physiological systems working, you're much more likely to be able to do the therapy that you need to do. So with people who have problems with excessive hand washing, they can learn to give that up. You know, people who are aggressive, they can learn to settle themselves and practice not acting on their anger. And so on. So compassion-focused therapy, I think, is gradually infiltrating many other therapies.
Mm-hmm.
Because the other therapies can stand as they are, but the compassion component will make those therapies better and stronger.
What about penetrating education? It occurs to me that that would be another very important area to strike early.
Yes, that's a great question, a wonderful question. I mean, because we do have a compassionate schools program, mm-hmm. and the Harvard University School of Education, also very interested in this development of pro-social behavior in children, because at the moment, the evidence is that over the last 20 years, children have become much more self-focused, much more narcissistic, much more worried about rejection, not doing well, much more focused on their own happiness. So you're absolutely right. The trying to help children beginning to see that compassion is a motivational system that will not only help their own minds, but will help their relationships and those around them. This is a wonderful aim, I think.
Yes, I agree. You know, I found myself wondering this morning as I was thinking about this interview and another movement that I've kind of followed is positive psychology. And I wonder to what extent you might have been influenced by that movement or be involved in that movement, et cetera.
Yeah, no, see, that's right. That doesn't mean that all the other psychology is negative psychology.
Right.
Positive psychology is more focusing on people's strengths, virtues, and abilities, as opposed to trying to rectify deficits. So Marty Seligman, who was one of the originators of it, was very concerned that, you know, we need to help people build on what they have as much as sort of try and undermine what they might feel they're not very good at. So that's really important. And there are many spiritual traditions that also do the same. Buddhism, of course, does the same. So helping people to build on their positives, to see their strengths, to see their virtues. In compassion-focused therapy, people often underestimate their own compassionate wisdom. And it's not until they put themselves into these states of mind that they suddenly realize, oh, yeah. You can do this at home. You can do this very simply. To work with a friend and sit together with one person as an A, one person as a B. And then A talks to B for 2 minutes about a little problem, and then B talks to A about a little problem. And if you're listening, if you're the listener, you can't speak. You can nod or say one word. So do that. And then after you've both spoken about your problem for 2 minutes to each other, stop. Do a compassionate exercise. Do the slowing of the breathing. Okay, do that for a couple of minutes, really slowing the body, then really focusing on yourself as a wise being, bring as much compassion, commitment as you possibly can to the situation, and then do the same thing again. And what people find is that when they actually talk about the problem again, the problem seems different somehow. It doesn't quite seem so overwhelming, or they find a new wisdom. So this is a very simple thing that people can do with each other, or friends with each other, to recognize that just getting yourself into the slowed mind state opens up your mind to find your own inner wisdom.
Oh, thank you so much for sharing that with us. That sounds like a wonderful exercise. I used to teach a class called Introduction to Counseling, undergraduate university course. And I would have students engage in co-counseling pairs and do exercises along those lines, but that's a different spin on it. I really like that. And unfortunately, I'm not teaching that class anymore, but you've put the seed out there, and there are other people listening who will be teaching classes like that. Well, I think we're at the point here maybe of winding down. Is there anything that you'd like to say that maybe you haven't had a chance to get out here?
No, just to say once again, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to talk to you. And I think your radio does fantastic in bringing these kinds of pieces of information to people who wouldn't otherwise have an opportunity to learn about them. And I think the key thing is that in the heart of most people is compassionate intention. It's just they don't always know how best to make that work within them. Yeah. And it's very easy to get pulled by tribalism or greed or fear or whatever. And holding to your compassionate attention is not always the easiest thing. But, you know, programs like you, I think, give people an opportunity to see ways they can do that.
Well, Dr. Paul Gilbert, I really want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm so glad I was finally able to connect with Dr. Gilbert. I appreciate the listeners who recommended him for an interview. He's incredibly busy conducting workshops, it seems, just about all the time. So I was glad to catch up with him. I found him to be a delightful guest, and I think he's doing good work in the world. In fact, it's heartening to know that there are these branches of psychology that are very specifically devoted to improving humankind. In a way, I suppose that could be said for the whole of psychology and psychotherapy, but I think that some seem to have given themselves a special mandate in that direction. To this point, I was initially surprised to learn that Dr. Gilbert's Compassionate Mind Foundation is actually set up as a charity. I don't know why that surprised me, but it did, and upon reflection, it does make sense. I was also surprised that Dr. Gilbert had spent time studying the Jungian perspective, because I knew that his initial training was in cognitive behavioral therapy, and that in many ways it underlies his approach to compassion-focused therapy. Another thing that you might find surprising is that he has the letters OBE behind his name, which stands for the Order of the British Empire. It's almost like a knighthood, honoring the recipient's contributions to British society. I encourage you to go to Amazon.com and look up Paul Gilbert there, and you'll find at least two books by him, The Compassionate Mind, A New Approach to Life's Challenges from 2010, and Mindful Compassion, The Science of Compassion Can Help You Understand Your Emotions, Live in the Present, and Connect Deeply with Others. As always, you're encouraged to use our Amazon.com widget in the right-hand sidebar should you decide to order one or both.
Dr. Dave, it's Rob Canora. I apologize for not calling sooner, but I did want to take the time to encourage you to continue your podcast. Love listening on a regular basis, and to encourage all your listeners who have not already to take the time to make what should be a one-time donation if you've only listened to one podcast. But if you're a regular listener like me, I encourage you to make an ongoing donation to support your continuing efforts and all the time and effort, obviously, that you put into to delivering such a wonderful regular update on all things psychological. Thanks again for your hard work, and keep it up.
Thank you, Rob Canora. I appreciate your ongoing contributions and those of others of you out there more than I can say. If you're not already a regular supporter of Shrink Wrap Radio, won't you please answer Rob Canora's call to action? I'm afraid we don't have any new donors since the last episode, but we do have a new transcript. It's number 541, My Shamanic Path with Sergei Baranov, and that transcript is thanks to listener's volunteer, James Stake. I just noticed a new problem with leaving comments on our site. It looks like starting with number 543, Trauma Therapy with Guy McPherson, and earlier, the invitation to leave a comment is missing. I've contacted my web guy about this, and hopefully we'll get that repaired. Finally, if you're not already an Audible.com subscriber, you can get both of Dr. Paul Gilbert's books in audiobook form. There's his book, The Compassionate Mind, and also his other book, Mindful Compassion. And you can listen to a free sample of each by going to audible.com. I know sometimes in the past I've played bits of those samples here on the show, but now that I'm sending these to the Internet Archive, I'm reluctant to do that. Might get into trouble. So if you're not already an audible.com subscriber, you can get this audiobook for free, or either one of these audiobooks for free, and to keep, with no obligation to continue your subscription, by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. And of course, if those are not to your taste, they have more than 250,000 other titles for you to choose from.
Hi, this is journalist Jamal Yogis, author of The Fear Project, here on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Jamal Yogis, who was my guest on number 334, The Fear Project. If you haven't heard it, that's a really good one. Here are a couple of recent emails from our listener community responding to my recent announcement that all of my Shrink Wrap Radio interviews are now on the Internet Archive, where they will stay long after I'm gone. First, we hear from Dr. Marion Rawlings, who writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, I hope you are well. I read with great interest that the entire archive of your interviews will be preserved in the public domain for future access. Your insightful interviews are a wealth of important historical documentation of contemporary psychology. A virtual treasure trove, no ego trip of self-importance, but rather a recognition of a body of work that is unrivaled in its scope and value to our field. In support, I'm sending in my donation. Thank you, Dr. Dave, for what you have done and are doing for psychology. Best regards, Dr. Marion Rawlings. And she is a New Jersey licensed psychologist, and I so much appreciate that affirmation. Surprisingly, not long after, I received another comment on my Internet Archive posts from another Marion, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I'm so delighted to learn that you have successfully archived all the shrink wrap shows. I totally agree with everyone who points out what a remarkable resource this podcast is. And to be honest, I actually have often felt a sense of worry about the ongoing availability of the material. So I just wanted to thank you not only for this amazing, rich, generous, and enlightening podcast, but for your perseverance in making sure it gets preserved. And thank you also for continuing to be such an inspiration with your work. It truly is an act of love and has blessed me and many others in myriad ways. I hope you live to be at least 100 and keep the great shows coming. Warm regards, Marion." Well, Marion and Marion, I thank you both so much. And I'll do my best to live till 100 and to at least 100 and keep the soul food coming. So with that, I think we'll wrap it up once again for today. Remember, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, at least recent shows. And you can leave voicemail on our phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Paul Gilbert, for enlightening us about compassion-based therapy. And yes, the pun is intended. Enlightenment, get it? Next week, my guest will be William Shanel on Carl Jung's Evolving Views of Nazi Germany. I suspect it may have some relevance for our own time. So hope to see you then. Until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.